I'm Nora Young, and this is Spark from your pals at CBC Radio. This time we're looking at the politics of technology and innovation. When we think of new digital tech, we often think about a handful of giant tech companies. But it turns out once we get beyond Silicon Valley, there are all kinds of inspiring stories of innovation.
Then we'll get the microphone close to you.
Great.
And then CBC should be there. So you should.
And I'm going to just charge my phone really quick.
Hello, Ramesh. Can you hear me?
Hey there. Hi, Nora. Just one sec. I'm just plugging in one thing.
Sure.
Okay, yeah.
Perfect.
Okay.
I'm totally ready and excited. My name is Ramesh Srinivasan, and I am a professor at UCLA in the Department of Information Studies, and you can engage with me on Twitter at Ramesh Media.
Ramesh is also the author of Beyond the Valley, how innovators around the world are overcoming inequality and creating the technologies of tomorrow.
What is actually occurring is deeply inefficient and deeply undemocratic and deeply imbalanced in the relationship between those who control those vocabularies of digital technology and the rest of us.
Indeed, the first part of Ramesh's book is a critique of the power structure of internet-based technology, which is overwhelmingly dominated by a handful of companies based in the US and in China.
What arrives at our fingertips, what we see on our screens, even what is collected or known about us to influence our life chances in ways over which we have no understanding, visibility, or control, all of those are digital experiences. Those are forms of technologization that are dominated and determined by just a few private, for-profit corporations that by their very definition are interested in amassing as much profit as possible and expanding their valuation. So that zero-sum model by which technologization occurs and by which technologies are influencing our lives is one that will break many of the social and political and economic systems that people kind of need and they sign on to when they become part of a democratic society, when they believe in the social contract for work that, you know, working hard means that you'll gain enough to be able to support you and your family. So those are just being eroded as we speak by privatized, centralized control over the so-called decentralized internet.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a bit about China's tech titans and how they differ from the U.S. in terms of how they use their power and what their relationship with government is?
So, you know, American-dominated tech follows a certain kind of ideological or value proposition of so-called free market capitalism, right? Which is, don't regulate us, let us run free. The more we grow, the better we are. Whatever, it's business interests. That's a very kind of American ideology. In the Chinese case, it's somewhat different. There has to be a tight-knit relationship with the essentially authoritarian policies and approaches of the state. So there is a great interest in extracting data and putting data on the cloud in AI, artificial intelligence investments and machine learning investments. But there's also an interest in the use of technology to discipline populations and that the tech companies themselves have to be tightly in lockstep with the dictates of the state. So, you know, Chinese tech execs off the record tell me stuff like, you know, our only goal, and it sounds like American, similar to American kinds of examples, our goal is just to grow. It doesn't matter to what extent, with what effects, as long as we are following, you know, the Chinese value system. Perhaps the most well-known example of this is the Chinese social credit system, mm-hmm. right? Which is, you know, there was that Black Mirror episode that kind of described it, Nosedive. I recommend all our listeners to check that one out. Where it's like a world where everyone is constantly scoring everyone else. And based on that score, you have your life chances are either foreclosed or opened up.
I see there's one standby seat on another plane leaving tonight. That's reserved for members of our Prime Flight program. You got to be a 4.2 or over to qualify.
Oh, I'm a 4.2.
I'm afraid you're actually a 4.183.
Oh.
There's a credit score being developed about you. You have no idea as a citizen what the data are that are being used to develop that credit score. You're not sure how that data are being analyzed. All you know is you are just in the dark. And then basically what you can and can't access and how you live is determined for you. So that is a very authoritarian kind of system.
Can't you just...
I'm sorry, it won't let me book it without the correct ranking.
But it's so close.
There's just nothing I can do.
Because that actually impacts not just, you know, as per the Black Mirror episode, whether someone can rent a car or get on a flight or the class of train that they can access, but actually stuff that's much more fundamental. Whether they can receive a loan, mm-hmm. whether they can access housing, what type of healthcare they might access. And so there's a sense of power and control and servility in a sense that is associated with the Chinese social credit system.
Mm-hmm. So what role does the so-called attention economy and the huge amount of data that these companies have about us play in this?
It's just astonishing that we have no understanding of how the more we give our attention, the more we transact our lives and give it away as a resource that can be mined, exploited, extracted, used in ways over which we have no visibility at all.
Yeah. I mean, because this is the thing, the ideology that we have is we think of the internet as this vast open source of information, but how does the power structure of these companies limit the kind of information we get or even allow public opinion to be manipulated? Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, computational choices are being made based on optimizing for one core dependent variable, which is keep people's attention. So, you know, how did we come to this place? Internet was publicly funded by U.S. taxpayers 50 years ago. Web was a nonprofit technology to allow researchers to communicate with one another. As the internet expanded and democratized in access, both in North America as well as across the global north, it felt very democratic. But as that amount of information that came online expanded, as computational advances allowed for all that information to be stored pretty much for free, as computer processing became exponentially faster, basically it turned into a situation where any information, any data, any time online, you know, go on to the cloud, just live on some mysterious server somewhere. And so what ended up happening is that astronomical amount of information that we now see on the internet today, much of which is dominated by video content, actually, mm-hmm. led to a situation where we, and it's understandable, where we had to turn to various applications and services to make sense of things, to guide us, right? So these guides became our guides to social life. Our guides to media, which is Facebook. Facebook's the biggest media, not just tech, biggest media company in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. We received guides to taxi services. That's Uber. We received guides to accommodation. That's Airbnb. They call themselves tech companies, but they're actually platform intermediaries that are interested, and here's the key point, in obviously optimizing for their own private benefit, their own value. But the ways in which they choose to do so are not publicly known. Mm-hmm. So that's what's at stake here. That's how that happened.
The scientist lived in a world of matching, in which, and his idea of proof or verification is just matching evidence against evidence. When somebody doesn't match, but makes a new breakthrough, this is just as disturbing to the scientist as to the educator. It upsets the whole apple cart.
This is Spark.
This is Spark.
You're listening to Spark.
Spark.
You're listening to Spark.
From CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young. Right now, my guest is Ramesh Srinivasan. He's a professor of information and design at UCLA. He's also the author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. So the back part of Beyond the Valley is all about learning from innovation, no surprise, beyond the valley, particularly East Africa and Mexico, and particularly in the power of constraints in innovation. Can you expand on that aspect of it?
Yeah, so part of what's occurred is the hijacking of terms and brands categories by big tech companies. You know, so we, you know, often when we hear the word innovation these days, or even when we hear the word disruption, it's pretty easy to just think, hey, that's Steve Jobs, or hey, you know, that's, well, we used to think that was Mark Zuckerberg. More or less, there's this kind of corporate mythology that has taken, that is, has discursively appropriated terms like innovation, disruption, and so on. But I ask the question through examples I tell, through stories I gather from you know, the great privilege I have to travel all over the world and see what technology actually means to the 99%, the dominant majority of technology users, even Facebook and Google users, aren't in Canada. They're not in the United States. They're not even in Europe. They're in the continents of the global South, Africa, South America and Latin America, Asia, and so on. So I looked at these examples in action and I saw a whole new understanding, a whole new definition, which rung really true of what innovation actually is. Innovation is about doing more with less, resourceful. The constraints that people face, I'm not trying to exoticize this, but the constraints people face actually force a type of innovation, a type of creativity that would not be possible if you simply thought you had infinite access resources, which we know in many cases actually contribute to things like climate change. So let's compare and contrast two like sort of snapshots. One is, you know, our purchase of iPhones. We know when we, and Apple's even admitted it, we know when we purchase iPhones that they have an expiration date built into them. They are designed to die, so we have to buy more. This is a strategy called planned obsolescence. We also know that the externalities of that, like the effects of that, aren't just about having to buy more stuff, but that these devices can contribute to e-waste. And in fact, these devices are even partially created through the extraction of minerals like coltan from places like the Congo, and so on. So that's one model, right? That's the kind of Western myth of infinite resources. You know, you buy and you buy and you buy and you kind of you externalize the expenses, whether they're environmental or they're labor-based or so on. That's one model. Another model could be to look at what happens to those phones when they sit in landfills outside of Nairobi, or they somehow enter into people's lives in Uganda or even in Ghana. So we do, and if we start to look beyond the valley, you start to see a whole other model of what people do with these tools, with these devices, with these systems. Yes, they are, unfortunately, in some cases, trying to just extract the metals out of it and getting cancer. And we've seen examples of that in countries like Ghana. However, what we also see are people opening up these technologies and rewiring them, repairing them, reconstructing them, hacking them, really hacking them, right? Rigging them. These are like kind of just colloquial terms to describe this. People are giving technologies we treat as dead, as environmentally wasteful, and they're giving them new forms of life. And I give the astonishing example of an organization called Africa Born 3D, mm-hmm. AB3D, that has built 3D printers out of, I think it's about 50% e-waste, like just yeah. junk. And they are literally recovering that waste and creating new 3D printers, incubating a business that serves its community, hiring people. It's a whole other model of innovation. And here's the crazy thing. The technologies they built outperform, in many cases, and are much cheaper than Western and Chinese 3D printers because they're built by innovators in places with an understanding of the constraints they face for people in their own worlds.
Yeah, you call that broken world thinking, right? This idea that you're designing for a world in which some things don't necessarily work properly. And I want to get into one example, which is the example of, I guess it's BRCK, B-R-C-K, in Kenya.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What is that, and what does that example teach us about innovation?
You know, BRCK was founded by one of the founders of a Kenyan open source technology called Ushahidi that even President Obama praised when he went to Kenya back in 2008. And Ushahidi was an open source platform that anyone could use anywhere to monitor corruption, election violence, and so on. And it started out of Nairobi, and then it traveled all over the world. It was used in the Haitian earthquake. It was used in multiple U.S. presidential elections. It's been used hundreds of thousands of times. So this kind of model of working with the constraints of a place to build innovations that work for that place that can then travel from Africa to other parts of the world is kind of incredible.
Mm-hmm.
BRCK is a hardware project. It's an initiative that's dedicated to democratizing and spreading free Wi-Fi and network connectivity access to people all over East Africa. And it uses renewable energy and solar energy as well. That's also possible to charge the battery. But these are basically cheap, robust, designed, you know, again, in this way of being resourceful, designed for the environment, designed for the Nairobi environment, designed for the African environment, the physical environment, to last there. But this is basically, they're spreading these Wi-Fi routers, and they've even set one up in the Dadaab refugee camp, which is in northern Kenya, right near the border of Somalia. And so their idea is, hey, let's look at the constraints, right? The electrical grid is a constraint. It's just not as functional. So let's leapfrog it, right? Let's look at the opportunities. We have lots of sun. We also know that we can provide people with access to this kind of network connectivity, and that can have, it's not always sufficient, but that connectivity can give people opportunities to be entrepreneurial in ways that they never would be able to otherwise. And you really see that in Kenya, not just with BRIC, but you can see a whole ecosystem of entrepreneurialism. Some people have like normal jobs that are not that great, but they develop tech businesses of all types. They're prototyping, 3D printing, you know, building everything and anything. Mm. And some of these innovators really start on the street. You know, they it's literally a table, a soldering gun, and a person's creativity. They're not formally trained in engineering. They just hack it. They figure it out. And they call themselves Jua Kali, which in Swahili means hot sun. So it's just a pretty incredible thing to see. It's actually very heart-opening and uplifting when you see, hey, this is another whole model of what innovation is and can be. It's innovation where people have power. It's people's creativity. It's people's aspirations.
This farmer developed this fridge made entirely of clay, and it basically consumes no electricity and can keep fruits and vegetables fresh for 5 days, and it cost about $25 or so. Hi, I'm Navi Raju. I am an innovation and leadership consultant based in Silicon Valley. And in Africa, you also see similar things where it's very common practice, for example, to recharge cell phone using bicycles or send receive money using mobile phones without having a bank account.
It's a very different model than this kind of blinders on zero sum model that we know is generating even greater inequality and injustice. And so in that sense, we can learn a lot from these examples all over the world. And some of them are even here in the United States. You know, like Detroit runs a community-run network. Bernie Sanders, has been advocating for a municipal-run and community-run broadband. You know, so there's all these other ways which we can shift the governance and ownership and design prowess around technology and head in a direction that lifts all boats. Sure lifts business boats, but not at the cost of everybody else.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're questioning here a pretty big article of faith, which is that putting technology in the hands of people in the developing world is automatically a good thing, this sort of technology transfer idea that, you know, people in the West will just give technology to people in the developing world. So what's wrong with that way of thinking about the spread of technology?
If your goal is to just get people to be more cogs in the machine, more data bodies, more data producers for your systems that are built thousands of miles away that are reinforcing the biases of the West, let alone the biases of dominantly Western males and white males who build those technologies, then you're not really creating anything that's even close to democratizing when you're just trying to lock people into your networks and systems, right? And so that's why we see definitely a lot of energy and attention going into, for example, the African continent by a lot of the American and Chinese big tech companies, because they realize that that's the place where the internet is most rapidly expanding. That's where the youngest population in the world is. That's kind of the new frontier, if you will, for the internet. Yeah. And so what I'm trying to ask for is, if you are going to try to service those populations and really extract from those populations, you need to be accountable to those populations as well. And that's why we see so many false positives with AI bias issues, algorithmic systems built in Silicon Valley, even in China, that turn out to be racist. That's the lack of accountability combined with the extraction of people's data that is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as you mentioned, big tech is starting to invest more in Africa, most notably Google in Accra, Ghana,
yes.
Microsoft in Nairobi and Lagos. What do you make of what they're doing there? Is that a good thing?
It's a smart idea on their part, absolutely. I mean, I think some of these embarrassing situations are ones that the companies do not want, and I'm not sure what exactly they're trying to do about it, but I would imagine that them setting up offices on the African continent are their attempts to be more like accurate, if you will, to the communities that are out there so that their services can be more sustainably used.
My name is Zachary Drucker. I'm a producer and an artist and a human and a trans person. You know, I think that in the 1950s, everybody was watching a black and white television in their homes. And like today, we have full color HD, like bordering on 3D and virtual reality. And like, why would all the other kind of areas of our culture not shift accordingly? You know, I think that gender too is this really unique thing. Everybody has their own way of being in the world. And it's important to recognize all of those colors.
I'm Nora Young, and I'm speaking with Ramesh Srinivasan, author of Beyond the Valley, which explores innovation around the world. One group of innovators he profiles in the book is at Makerere University in Kampala, Uganda. They use AI for things like agriculture and traffic monitoring.
These are some of the extremely brilliant machine learning and AI researchers, and they are trying to build AI systems partly using AI and machine learning models that might come out of the West or that are open source up on GitHub or what have you. And their idea is to feed the systems that they're developing various types of data sets that are local, right? So trying to build bottom-up AI for their people, by their people. However, they are stuck having to depend on foreign aid, right? Because very few investors or VCs want to invest in African tech companies. They're seen as risky. They're seen as unstable. They're not seen as worth those investments. So a group like the AI Lab, I mean, of course, it's a nonprofit, but they're not able to access a lot of secure funding because there's very little governmental funding. And the funding they are able to get to allow them to build out their technologies comes from, you know, United Nations, like sustainable development goals and stuff. And so as a result, what they build AI around, the questions they answer, even their applications of these models, perhaps even their development of these algorithmic systems are largely dependent on the funding goals that they have to adhere to. So in a sense, that kind of constrains what they can do. So as a result, you don't see a lot of AI systems being built by these folks in Uganda or generally in the African continent that really deal with issues of cultural diversity or linguistic diversity, because that's not what these development goals are funding.
Mm-hmm. So when you look at some of these examples and the way innovation comes out of things like constraints or vulnerabilities and the use of local context, all these things, what lessons do these examples have for technologists and designers here in North America?
So I think what we can do here in North America is understand and recognize the costs that our current model have borne upon for not only the users of these technologies, our larger societies, and perhaps even on some level, the businesses themselves, because of bad press, but also because if they are contributing to such an unequal world, that's not going to be good for their own businesses themselves, because the value of the rest of us will drop. I mean, it's a bit of a cynical way of looking at it, but it's sort of a thought experiment. So what can we do instead? Well, let's think. For example, the right to repair, for some bizarre reason, is not something that has yet come into law here in the United States. If anything, we can understand how much value can be created by more sustainable forms of design, or at least allowing for repair, for recycling, those kinds of alternative, informal, and secondary and tertiary economies to emerge out of what occurs, so we don't restrict the magic of innovation to some, you know, elite design lab. So that's like one, right? So like by learning and by working with these kinds of innovators in the global south, and even fostering an economy of these types of repair and recycle innovators across the global north. So that's just like one example, right? Or AI systems that it turns out are turning out to be racist or at the minimum culturally biased. Instead, what if those AI systems were at least partially designed or audited even by groups like the Makerere Lab in Uganda? Hmm. That's another model that we can engage with. So more or less what I'm trying to get at is greater collaboration, greater control, greater visibility. Like as technology globalizes in its reach, so too must the voices that inform the ways those technologies are developed, their auditing, and even their monetization.
So if you could suggest, you know, one change in terms of the culture of, let's just call it Silicon Valley, what would you like to see happen in terms of resetting our relationship with the big tech companies?
Yeah, it's time for Silicon Valley to engage in a social contract. If you want to really have a relationship with your users or your user populations, you need to tell them what you know about them. Mm-hmm. You need to explain, what do you know? How do you know it? How long do you know it for? What do you do with it? Right? I mean, those are sort of just ways in which you come clean and be communicative. So that's like one step. Second is in America, we have these data brokers that we can buy our credit card records from and so on. You know, all of that immediately needs to be made explicit, transparent, and possibly banned. Then a third layer to this is what happens at scale. If 47% of people are in threat of having their jobs replaced by automated technologies, if gig economy workers are more disenfranchised than ever, if traditional taxi drivers are killing themselves, if longshoremen who are being replaced by automated systems are freaking out, we need to restore a balance that's of a technological world that does support working people. Like, what would it look like if an Uber or something like that existed that had the efficiency of that platform, but where the workers for Uber had some equity in the business, even owned the business? So at scale, we need to really think about workers and economic issues. And then the last layer to this is every time we interact with an AI system, which we are all the time, it not only needs to be disclosed to people, but we need to know what they know about us. We need to be able to say, hey, you can't have this data or that data about us. We should own our data. But also the voice of communities that are most vulnerable in relation to those systems, like predictive policing systems or AI systems being used in courts. Those communities can't just be victimized by those systems, black and brown communities. They need to be involved in the design of those systems itself. So the biases of our world are being worsened and normalized by technology. And in Beyond the Valley, I say, hey, okay, we are at this situation, but there's a heck of a lot we can do about it. And that's why this book ultimately, believe it or not, is positive. I know I'm kind of laughing when
positive,
I say that.
It is positive, yes. Ramesh, thanks so much for your thoughts on this.
I loved talking to you. Thanks for the great questions.
Ramesh Srinivasan is the author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow.